Ignite your curiosity with Austin Next. We're watching Austin transform from a thriving ecosystem into a global superstar. With our host, Jason Scharf, we aspire to better comprehend the true nature of innovation. Together, we will uncover what makes a successful ecosystem and navigate the technologies shaping our future. Now let's dive into What's Next?
I am jumping back into the weird world of quantum technology. Have we hit a pivotal moment in research and development so that we can now deploy it? Does the sector require a different way of thinking? And finally, is Austin primed to lead? Joining me today is Scott Ferris, a veteran of the space to explore all of the spooky stuff of this growing industry. Scott is a seasoned technology executive and venture finance and innovation strategy professional with nearly 30 years entrepreneurship, senior management, and technical leadership experience in seed stage investment, venture-backed startups, and established public and private technology firms with a global presence. Scott provides senior strategic, financial, and technical leadership and advisory services to the global innovation sector, including startup and established technology companies, institutional private equity investment funds. Scott's management and entrepreneurship expertise includes a diverse track record in new venture investment, technology company startup and scaling operations, innovation process management, including technology commercialization, corporate development, strategy and strategic alliances, federal and commercial business development. Corporate strategy and development experience includes the following. With a principal focus on technology and energy industries, corporate strategy design and execution, change management, process improvement, management team development for growth. Scott is also experienced in M&A strategy and targeting, new market entry, growth strategy, and competitive strategy. Scott has served as an officer and director in regional and state technology and economic policy organizations. In addition to his governance roles, he provides leadership in the areas of science, technology, and innovation policy, strategy, and execution for national, state, regional organizations, venture capital firms, major corporations. Scott is active in state, region, economic cluster development policy and program strategy and management. I hope you enjoy our exploration of the spooky science and its impact on innovation. Scott, welcome to Austin Next.
Thanks. Glad to be here today.
All right. I need to start off really big picture here. I've done quantum technology episodes before, but it's weird and confusing and I think takes a bit of understanding of what we actually are talking about. I did like when we were talking before, you mentioned that we're taking advantage of spooky stuff.
Yeah.
So can we start off with kind of back to the basic primer? What is the fundamental science behind quantum technology and what exactly does this unlock?
Yeah. So look, quantum mechanics, you probably studied this in high school. If you're ambitious, you may have studied some of it in college. Most people weren't that ambitious. I certainly wasn't. But look, I think the idea is this is physics. This is, you know, kind of the rules of how things work. This is how matter works, how energy works. And over centuries, over years, we've gotten better at understanding how it works at smaller and smaller levels of refinement. I mean, the era we live in now, the nuclear age, was really starting to unlock how atoms behave, you know, and what we can do with them. And for the last 70 years, we've lived with the destructive side of unlocking atoms. But what's happened is now we've gotten to the point, a lot of this is because we have things like high-performance computing and machine learning and all these tools that we've built are now allowing us to understand how to manipulate what I call the positive aspects of quantum physics. How do we unlock the atom to do productive things? And the reason that people are really interested in this is when you get to that level of physics, it's a different kind of step down, new phenomena occur. Phenomena we've understood. I'm going to say that most people don't understand it. And I think the first rule is don't try and understand it. You don't know how your iPhone
things
works.
Like the double slit experiment and the like, we still don't understand why that's happening.
Yeah, but it's predictable, it's scalable. And when it becomes predictable and scalable, it becomes a tool, like anything else. And so, as I tell people, don't try to understand the physics, you know, this spooky physics, that's the best name they could come up with at the time. So, but we now have, we can now unlock it as a tool, and it gives us a really a treasure chest of interesting things that we can do when we look at how atoms behave and how we interface with atoms. And the way to think about this is that what this really allows us to do is to do things at levels of precision and accuracy that just really aren't touchable with existing technologies. It allows us to do things at speeds that aren't necessarily with existing technologies. And so in a sense, this unlocking of this suite of quantum physics allows us to do a wide variety of things. And the way I tell people to think about this is that, you know, there's a lot of conversation around quantum computing and everything that quantum computing is going to do for us. And like any large, big transformational technology, we always like to focus on the most challenging problem and all the wonderful things that it unlocks. I have autonomous driving. One morning we were going to wake up and have self-driving cars. Well, it keeps getting pushed out because it's a complex activity. But much like with autonomous driving, you're seeing things creep into the system in the autonomy world where pieces of it are being unlocked while you kind of continue on your way to full self-driving. And I mean, quantum is going to unlock.
I think that's a great example. Like, I just, you know, I have a Tesla, and they gave out the new FSD, and we've started playing with it, and it is pretty amazing. While it may not be level 3, 4, or 5. I don't remember the exact level here, but it's not the end goal that we're thinking about of what autonomous driving will be. Yeah. It's something that I can use and is interesting versus what was available before.
It gives you incremental performance and improvement to unlock new things that you can do. And quantum is going to unlock the same way, because you have to go back to the continuum. You, on the most complex, challenging side, you have quantum computing. And the way I describe that to people, if you look at all the quantum physics effects you unlock in quantum computing, you're trying to do all of them at the same time.
Easy, simple, right?
Yeah, it's like trying to be a goat of all sports simultaneously. It's probably doable, but you're going to not start off doing that. You got to kind of master these tasks individually. And so if you look at the other side of quantum, and where I think you'll see quantum just kind of creep into our lives, it's on unlocking individual quantum physics effects. And this will start certainly in areas like precision time. How do we tell time more accurately? How do we distribute time more accurately? People don't think about these things, but everything runs on time. The world runs on time. And if you can improve time efficiency and time distribution, things move faster. Computers can move faster. Networks can move faster. And certainly with all the challenges we're seeing with scaling AI, if you can start to get productivity improvements in existing data infrastructure by changing time protocols, that's a huge advantage. It's a huge advantage in terms of reduced CapEx. It's a huge advantage in reduced energy consumption. Again, one of the challenges with scaling data centers is they just consume a massive amount of energy. And so quantum is going to start to solve these problems while we work our way up to quantum computing. Again, the debate is when does the magical moment in quantum computing happen? It's not in the next 3 years, but I don't think it's beyond 10 years. And so I think in the lifetime of history, technology cycles, it's upon us. But it that level needs some more time to bake.
So right now, when, like everybody else, as you said, like when I think about quantum, I'm thinking about the quantum computers, and then I hear a lot of these, you know, like quantum sensing, quantum cryptography. Right. And so your point in that it's creeping in early into new technology, similar to what we're talking about, like with autonomous driving.
Right.
So without me having a PhD in physics, how is it creeping in without us solving the quantum computing question? How are we able to take advantage of that?
Yeah, that's a good point. And so I think, again, one of the other fallacies that exists, and I think it's because the narrative around quantum computing started off with quantum computing, is one of the things that makes quantum computing so challenging is that the data itself, you're manipulating data while it's in a quantum state, which is very challenging. This is where, two things can be at the same universe at the same time. This is where you unlock all the spooky physics, but you're unlocking that because you're actually doing computation in a quantum state. So the data by nature is a quantum state. That's hard to do. It's very noisy. It's prone to lots of errors. And those are issues that are getting worked. How do you create a more stable environment? How do you create a less noisy environment? And it's getting resolved by improvements in the hardware itself and improvements in software. So there's kind of this natural, the computers are getting better, the software is getting better, and so there's a convergence point. And again, the debate is when that is, and to some degree it depends on the application. There's another world of quantum where the data itself is traditional data. It's not in a quantum state. It's just traditional bits and bytes, zeros and ones. And that's where you're going to see quantum be deployed much sooner. And these are what I call these quantum-enabled machines. Some people call this quantum-inspired. But basically, again, you're using not all of the suite of quantum physics. You're using maybe one or two, a handful of them to do things like make a better clock. An optical quantum clock can tell time 1,000 times better, 10,000 times better than traditional clocks. And so I was like, well, who cares, right? Like my watch is accurate enough. I show up on time. And what you have to take a step back and think about is that we live in a world where it's machines dealing with machines. Mm-hmm. And machines don't have these self-imposed limitations that humans place upon themselves based upon thousands of years of modern history. Machines will move as fast as the network allows them to. And so if you can increase time accuracy, you can increase, again, the throughput of data networks. You can increase the throughput of data centers. You can process things faster. So just by telling time using quantum mechanics, but the actual time signal that comes out is just a traditional signal. You can literally plug it into a network and it's like, oh, it's more accurate time.
So how does, let's go through the clock example a little more in depth. Like, how does a quantum clock work versus, I don't know, is it atomic clock? I don't know what the right word is, but the current.
Yeah, there's different ways of looking at it. Basically what we're doing is we're in that particular space, you're effectively putting in this case, you're doing atoms. So atoms are really the kind of the foundation of this. You're putting them into a very quiet state. Again, think about how small an atom is, and any energy, any noise around it, just as a distraction, because the signals are so minor. You've got to have it in this pristine state. And when you get into a pristine state, then you can manipulate it. And a lot of the manipulation is done by basically shooting lasers at it, right? You're basically you're changing the energy state of the atom by basically introducing, in a controlled way, you're introducing energy into the system. This is really, really minute stuff. But but through that, you can basically, the way they vibrate, the way they spin, again, depending on the application, you can start to measure their state. And from that, you can extrapolate like things like time. There's a world that are called Rydberg sensors, for example, where you're not necessarily you're letting electromagnetic energy in, RF signals. So the signals that come into your cell phone is an RF signal. So you can leak RF signals in there and understand they'll act as antennas at that point because they'll respond to the environment. So again, one thing to walk away with is that what this world of quantum is putting the atoms or the qubits, there's different ways of doing this, but putting them into a state where you can purposely manipulate them either through what you want to do, or you can purposely manipulate them by letting the world kind of into the box at that point, right? In the RF world, we're letting some RF energy in and we're watching how they behave. And again, they behave in a very predictable scale of fashion, but their sensitivity, and this is the real point, their sensitivity is orders of magnitude better than what you can get with traditional technologies. And so in the RF space, you can build antennas that are 1,000 times more energy efficient than the existing antennas hanging on cell towers today. And what does that mean? Well, that means that the battery life on your cell phone could last 1,000 times longer because most of your power is on transmit. So you can transmit smaller signals. It means you could see signals that you can't see today. And so in the military world, certainly in the Ukraine and in places where you have what are called contested environments where people are actively jamming signals, you can still see signals through that noise because your receivers are so sensitive. You can see signals you can't see using existing technologies. And so this is, again, these are lots of examples where you'll see quantum just kind of creep in. And a lot of these applications initially will be in the defense and security world, but they all have commercial analogies, right? You'll see quantum become part of 6G, and sort of, you think far down the sort of 7G, you know, it could largely be a quantum ecosystem.
So you said that we're 3 to 10 years possibly away from hitting whatever the milestone, whether it's quantum supremacy or whatever term we want to use in this. But that being said, it feels, just from where I sit in the zeitgeist of the moment, that we're at a pivotal moment in quantum. So what's driving that if we're still, you know, maybe a decade away from the moment in quantum computing?
Yeah, I think
why is it suddenly now back?
No, that's a great question. And I think most people don't really understand the kind of macro environment that's involving. If you take a step back through history, quantum products, quantum development is, you know, predominantly funded by the U.S. government, some private companies. IBM certainly been working on superconducting approaches for quantum computing for decades. And it's hard. It's the hardest of the hard. This is like, you know, we're reinventing the transistor. If you think about this in a very basic sense, what this leads to is a world where you build transistors and circuits atom by atom. As opposed to the way we do it now, we, you know, basically take bulk material and we figure out how to, you know, make it smaller and make small lines and all that. There's a transition point, if, you know, certainly in the semiconductor industry, you know, state of the art right now is called these one nanometer fabs, right? These are $50, $60 billion fabs. TSMC's announced one of them. The thing to take away from that at 1 nanometer is you're now actually the actual lines in the integrated circuits are how many atoms wide. So there's a world where it's like, okay, well, now you got to start building them atom by atom. And that's kind of what quantum also is starting to do. So why is this important? It really has not been important other than you want to maintain a research lead. That's kind of been the global race, is you don't want anyone to get ahead of you. You want to kind of maintain state of the art in research. But what's changed is the world has changed. So there's two big things that in the last 24 to 36 months that I think has changed the entire environment and is pushing this technology out of research and into commercial applications. The first is just this, what's called the great power competition, right? The geopolitics in the world have changed dramatically in the last 3 years. And there is a race between the U.S. and countries like China and others to really define economic futures. And quantum is ground zero for that. It is an entire new industry. It's an entire new way of doing things. It is what's beyond semiconductors in many ways. And so the West has basically had a strong position over the last 70 years because the integrated circuit technology, all the things that we enjoy today, the reason we can have this call, the reason that we have a video, is that's all technology that's been developed largely in scale in the West. Now, over the last 2 decades, we've kind of let others make it for us, which we're trying to fix that with the CHIPS Act. But quantum is a whole new game. And you know, quantum is one of these technologies that there's definitely a first mover advantage. Because if things move exponentially and you have one cycle advantage over somebody and things are growing exponentially, it is almost impossible to catch up. And, you know, this means, you know, what is your economic might, industrial might as a country, as a region, as an ideology? So it's a big stakes issue at this point. So that's the big thing, is that I think, particularly if you look at conflict zones, as I said earlier, how do you operate in GPS denied environments? If you need to defend an ally or you need to do something that you know, like we're seeing in the Ukraine right now, it's one of the most highly contested electronic warfare places in the world. And how do you work in that environment when, you know, the military is largely a you know, they've got data networks, they've got everything, they've got information sharing. You have to transmit information, and you can't do that in contested environments. Quantum is a way out of that. It starts to fix those issues. It operates outside the norm. So that's one reason you see so much interest. There's the demand signal is we need to deploy this as literally a superior technical capability for our own national security. The second demand signal is really, again, AI is pushing the boundaries of processing. And, you know, the world we live in now is, you know, how many factories do you build for GPUs? How many data centers do you build? How many new nuclear power plants? I mean, think about this, is, you know, nuclear power was a dirty word in the United States And it's all of a sudden in vogue, not because, quite frankly, we're trying to get rid of coal. It's in vogue because in order to scale data centers, you need to build a massive number of plants. And you can't do it. It has to be stable. You can't rely on renewable energy because it's not predictable. So nuclear power has come back into the discussion of scaling data centers. Quantum technologies help scale and help fix some of the quantum the AI processing issues. And so those are the two market signals that have emerged in the last 3 years. And so that's now creating a pool to get this technology out of research mode into commercial mode.
Has there also been just the fact that with the great power dynamic, I forget the exact word you used, competition that's going on right now, but also then the explosion of AI and just getting the sense of, oh, wow, we're seeing how much this stack starting to have a global effect, and this one, quantum, being a little bit behind, we should maybe be thinking about it more. And then the other question, you're talking about how quantum is affecting AI, but what about the other way around? How is AI?
Oh, it's having huge implications on quantum. So I said earlier, it's accelerating the rate of learning of how you program quantum computers that don't do very much, right? So the quantum algorithms and programming environments getting very robust because of all of this other technology. And so what you're really seeing is the convergence of quantum, which is, think about quantum, it's also a hardware-based revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing that I think most people don't recognize, because they think about quantum, they talk about computing, and then they talk about software. At the fundamentals of quantum, it's an entirely new generation of hardware capabilities. And that's one of the challenges that we have, is that, who builds the hardware? And I think from a national perspective, most of the PCs, when the PC industry started, were assembled in the United States. Some of the parts may have been made in Taiwan. I mean, certainly here in Austin, with Dell starting, Dell was importing, basically hard drives and stuff from Taiwan and assembling them here. But I think in the quantum world right now, the most of the manufacturing of core technologies isn't even in the United States anymore. So as a country, we actually risk missing out on an entire industry cycle because we don't have the industrial base. And so there's lots of factors that kind of come into this. And if you think about how important it is, and he was like, oh, and then we don't have the ability to actually do this ourselves. That's a scary situation to face, because now you're really subject to the whims of others and how this technology could be deployed, and where they want to give you access to the parts you need to make it yourself.
Right. And we all saw the effects of that during, the height of COVID and the lockdowns.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, we have the most advanced technology in the world, and if you can't make it, you can't ship it, you don't have it, then what good is it?
Well, there's entire factories in the United States that were shut down because we don't make connectors. Right? So a little 2-cent connector is like, oh, we don't want to make that anymore. Let's, that got offshored, like one of the first things that offshored. But, a country, if it's countries trying to recover, it's like, well, yeah, we're going to keep all the connectors ourselves to satisfy our industry, and, everyone else, you're on your own. And so, yeah, I mean, I think COVID really did lay ground to just how fragile the supply chains have become, not only just in terms of industrial capacity, but also distribution. I mean, we're seeing with a lot of the conflicts right now, shipping channels in free trade on open seas is being challenged. So now you got to, we can make it, but we can't get it to you. And so all these things are starting to come to bear of how do you build an industrial strategy, and how do you build an industrial strategy that allows you to lead the next generation of really what I call era-defining technologies, which quantum is an era-defining technology. It's, industrial 5.0, if you want to think about it that way.
Well, that's an interesting frame. I think it's a good moment to kind of pivot a little bit. You've been involved in this space for a while now, and you just launched a new venture. Why don't you kind of tell me?
For the last couple of years, I've been working with Infleqtion. We've been really kind of pushing the boundaries, a lot of this narrative of this is a national security issue. This is an industrial security issue. Doing that as a company, I recently stepped out to just now do that. I think that one of the missing things is this is such a big issue. It's beyond any one company to address this, and to me, it's a passion project. I, You know, I got into quantum 2.5 years ago specifically because I was very worried that as a country, you know, for lack of better of saying, we're going to blow it. And I've seen us just, you know, start, you know, we kind of lead in research and then we're complacent to let other people make things for us. We've seen this in batteries. We've seen this in wireless. We've seen this in multiple chapters in chips. And again, some of these things are recoverable, but quantum really isn't. As I said earlier, this is kind of a first mover advantage. And yes, the U.S. has been a leading country in quantum research. But what also occurred to me is this is a very different environment this time. I think unlike any environment the United States has ever seen, in that, you know, we're competing against an ideology. We're competing against a country that is, in fact, a company. And you know, we're competing against a capability. If you go back to the Cold War, you know, we were competing against a country that had technical depth, it's some industrial depth, but they didn't have a capital base. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the last time that the U.S. really competed globally with a country that had capital, had an industrial base, and had intellectual capital, really goes back to the first industrial revolution when we were competing with England. And we're at this point again where the competition is with a, you know, is with a country that has the three legs of the stool and the intent and will to win, because it's a high stakes game. And so for me, this is important for me, this is important for my kids, this is important for us as a country. If we want to live in a world that's open and democratic, quantum is going to be a battleground. It is a technology battleground. And I'm stepping out to figure out how do we get the hard conversations on the table.
So how do you think about the foundational aspects that will be good for quantum, but will be good across the board? And so what I'm thinking is, like, the move towards hard tech, physical product, like, right, there's a seems to be a general trend in there, whether it be things like, you know, Andreessen Horowitz's American dynamism, yeah, or the growth of these different things. So some stuff may be quantum specific, but it feels like that there are ways we can be thinking that will be kind of cross the board as we move towards, whether it be just software and physical coming together, or just straight up hard tech, deep tech.
Yeah. Look, I think that there's a bigger narrative here is as a country, you know, post-bubble, you know, the 2000s bubble, post-bubble, the investment community predominantly has become software centric. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we've had some evolution in hardware, but, you know, effectively the transistor architecture that we live on today has been around for a long time. It's improved and smaller and all those things, but it, you know, you didn't have to build all the pieces to do this. And, you know, I think what's starting to happen is we're having to go back and revisit that, you know, okay, we got to step up. This is a new rules, new game. You know, we got to figure out how do we invest in the companies to make the equipment, to make the chips. And if we don't, others will. And in fact, others already are. There was actually an announcement yesterday of a 200 euro fund in France to specifically assure European domination in the quantum race. I mean, that's pretty bold. And again, some efforts are coming together here in the States to do that. You've mentioned a couple funds. The DoD is doing some work. But we got to do this at scale, and we got to do this with like some sense of urgency. And I think that's the thing that's missing. Like, I'm a hardware guy through and through. And I love making things. And I, you know, I think, you know, I started off my career and, you know, physically making stuff. I grew up in a part in the worst of the Rust Belt where we made stuff. And it's just, I don't know, it's the water we drank or whatever. But I think we're at this moment where we have to really go back and embrace what's called techno-industrialism. Mm-hmm. Because when people say industry manufacturing, they think of like smoke, you know, plants spewing out all this. That's not what this is about. This is the modern age of technology-based industrialism. And as a country,
the Samsung plant here and the Gigafactory do not look like the old steel mills.
No, I think the Gigafactory is a great example, because what ultimately Tesla recognized is no one had solved the problem of how do you make EVs at scale. You know, that's a whole different problem than making the first 10 EVs.
Yeah,
I think there's a whole class of technologies we need to invest in around that.
Yeah, I think the line from Elon, I may butcher a little bit, was like, the factory is the product.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think what Tesla's been able to do, the tenacity, the ability to will this in existence, we have to repeat and scale this across these other industries. It's not just EVs. It's not just, I was in autonomy. These industries, this is what we're up against, is that we're up against a competitor who not only will it in existence, they will outspend us 10 to 1. I go back to my earlier point. When we were in the Cold War, we were up against a competitor that couldn't outspend us. And now we have someone that can amass the resources, you know, almost, you know, in kind of a dictatorial mode, but they're going to focus resources and tech, you know, intellectual resources and industrial resources to win this race. Cause they know if they win these races, they own the next 200 years. And that's what's at stake. And it's bigger than quantum.
Yeah. I mean, whether it be foundational AI models or quantum, yeah, in this case, there does seem to be a, even more so than kind of the internet age, but maybe not as we see, you know, we see small models or things of that nature where, yeah, there does seem to be very quickly kind of that segregation to be like, okay, there's three winners, right? It's, yeah, like the cloud war, right?
Yeah.
And so that you don't have a lot of opportunity, I think, to kind of break it once it happens. Now you can have things where you have true disruption where, you know, yeah, OpenAI is thrashing Google and search is, and they're in kind of in a moment of, you know, existential crisis, but I don't, yeah, think we want to wait for the whatever the next techno wave after quantum and AI is.
Yeah,
be like, this is how we're going to disrupt them.
Yeah. It's look, I think the big picture, right, I guess is beyond quantum, is the last 20, 25 years, you know, has been really driven by developing the digital world. The digital economy, there's, you know, we talk this every day, but basically everything we've invented has effectively been in digital.
Yeah.
And that's great because, you know, if you break it in digital, you go back and write some new code and, you know, put 10 more people in the same square 10-foot space somewhere and say, make it work. And generally they make it work. It's hugely capital efficient. The problem is the problems we face now are analog problems. These are things that exist in the real world. And what works in the digital world, you know, you can model this stuff all you want. And again, modeling getting better and better. But at the end of the day, it's the real world. Things happen in the real world that you can't control. And I think, you know, going back to your investment thesis is that's why hardware investing is risky, is you have to build it first to figure out if it works. If it doesn't work, you have to build it again. And these are long cycles, right? Time and money. And you can't go back and, you know, spend, you know, 3 days of, you know, 24-hour day programming to fix the digital problem. Now you got to go, oh, I got to go back 6 months. Like I ordered the wrong laser. I did this. I did that. All this doesn't work the right way. I got to redesign this. And so, but, you know, if we don't step up to take that on as a country and as capitalists in this country, others are. And we're seeing this in Europe, we're seeing this in China, we're seeing this in other places where they're willing to take on these hugely complex problems because they know it's to some degree, it's a winner take all kind of world we're starting to live in because these are transformational technologies. Again, I call these generational or era defining technologies.
But I mean, I'll take the positive side from the fact that since it's happening in the real world, yes, yeah, it's harder. But we look at some of the reasons why overall productivity since like the 70s hasn't been nearly as high is because it's these very narrow bands of, yeah, areas that we're increasing productivity. If you're suddenly increasing the innovations in the real world and how that affects, whether it's how we build houses, how we transport, yeah, how we go to space, what, like you start having back to that, you know, 1900s, 1950s type of.
That's, oh yeah. I mean, so what SpaceX has done, take the same, is hugely inspirational. You know, look what Icon's doing here in Austin with how you fundamentally change construction. I mean, that's an industry, and I came out of, you know, family of contractors. That's an industry that's never changed, right? And what they're demonstrating that they're able to do with these technologies is transformational for entire industry. You know, what's starting to happen in robotics, right? I mean, you got to build these things. They need to work. They need to, you know, they need to handle real-world stuff. And again, you know, era-defining technologies. And what's really fascinating, these are all happening at the same time. And this is I think, the real thing. These will converge. And I think what's really, really challenging is that if, you know, we talk about the quantum discussion, but if you look at the broader race, and you look at, again, a geopolitical lens on this, is that there is one country working to lead in all of these categories. Mm-hmm. And it's when you put them all together is really when things are dramatically different. If you can produce a workforce by basically sending a purchase order to a company and say, I need 10,000 more workers, next week or next month, right? It's a purchase order. And I don't care the conditions is because it's an economic asset. This was the genius of robo-taxis, right? And why did the big tech companies like Uber and Amazon, why were they investing in autonomy? Because they basically eliminated the driver, but they basically made the driving aspect a purchase order.
Right.
They had a limited capacity. I mean, Amazon, the only real limit to Amazon's growth is its ability to get product delivered.
Yeah, it's a small problem.
Yeah, and so if it's not a purchase order and it's a disposable purchase order, it's a whole different world. And I think these technologies, and again, quantum's going to play a piece in all this. Quantum is going to be an enabler for next generation highly accurate GPS. You don't need satellites for this. These things will intrinsically know where they are, based upon the gravitational field around them, based upon their ability to measure, the stars that we can't see. This is where these technologies all come to work together.
Well, and a lot of the companies we were just talking about are all here in Austin.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're talking about, the digital meets the physical, and quantum is part of that. So part of the origin of this episode was there was an article that came out and said Austin was one of the next quantum hotspots.
Yeah.
First, let's breakthrough, hype versus reality. How much is that true today, or was this at the end of like five if statements?
No, look, I think it's an accurate statement. And I think the reason it's accurate is because I go back to this initial premise, is that if the lens was, what are the great research epicenters in the world for quantum? Austin would not be on the list. There, nothing in Texas would be on the list. And it has nothing to do with info choices that were made. The traditional epicenters of quantum research have been tightly tied to the nuclear complex in the United States and globally. Mm. Right? To build nuclear weapons, you need the brightest physicists worrying about quantum physics to build nuclear weapons. And so those tend to have been historically where you have the greatest density of folks working on these issues. And you had most of the funding. It was national research funding. Again, every university's got some quantum research thing, but the scale was around really the national lab infrastructure. That's fine. That era is important, and we need to continue to invest in scaling that. But where we're not investing is scaling the commercialization. And this is where Austin in particular, I think, is so uniquely positioned, and Texas is so uniquely positioned in the United States, because it has the ecosystem. That's the first point, right? You've got all the semiconductor investment, all the infrastructure investment that we see going on around here, all the learning how to make, electric vehicles, the learning around that collective knowledge is important for critical mass to tackle these hard problems. Part of it is tactical knowledge of I understand physics. Part of it is the DNA. DNA is important to this. This is the infamous crossing the chasm problem. Mm-hmm. The reason most things never cross the chasm is most people argue, well, the company's not been capitalized the right way. I'd argue that that's part of the problem. I think the biggest problem that why companies don't cross the chasm is they can't change their DNA. It's a very different world to get out of bed every morning, get excited, and like, I'm going to go do some research and publish a paper and get recognized by my peers to do that. It's a very different world to say, I'm getting out of bed and I'm getting excited and I'm going to make 1,000 or 10,000, 100,000 of something, all of the same. If I'm a researcher, that's pretty damn boring, right? But the DNA of people that understand and relish doing that, that is Austin, that is Texas. The first semiconductor fabs in this country were built in the greater Austin area. They solved the hard problems. And so I think my view is that the reason that you saw that on the list is people are starting to recognize that you need to be in areas that relish and run towards these hard problems to solve these industrial manufacturing issues. And again, that's the reason I'm here, is that this is an easy place to do this, and it's an easy place to attract the talent that's not here that wants to do it.
Well, no, it's interesting, and as I've learned through the podcast and kind of gotten the history of Austin, we had all these semiconductor plants. Yeah. They left, or shrank. I'm not sure the exact. It's now we seem to be entering a new era of this manufacturing with these companies that we're talking about and yeah. additional things coming. So while it may have been in the DNA, there may have been some atrophy. So what's the gap, or is it just because of everything that's coming where it's actually we're speeding up because we're building rockets, we're building EVs,
I think there's certain stuff that left, there's certain stuff that grew here. So I said there's some atrophy around certain muscle. I think the fact that stuff left had nothing to do with Austin. It had to do with basically fundamental policy at the federal level of not recognizing, and in fact, and I would view, and actually encouraging industry to go offshore because it's cheaper, right? You know, once you solve the hard problem, then just scaling it is not as hard. And you know, I think we just had this philosophy, you know, a lot of companies had this, is like, I'm going to go somewhere where I can save a few cents because, you know, it makes my shareholders happy, right? I mean, look, that's capitalism. That's the way it works. So there's a price you pay at some point in the future for that. And we're at that moment, right? Where we've got like, okay.
Right. Those long supply chains were led to both lower prices, lower costs for the manufacturers, and lower prices for consumers.
Yeah.
And, but there was an inherent fragility in it.
Yeah, what's the total cost of something, right? That's one of the things we've not looked at before. I mean, this is to a large degree the debate around, you know, basically the green economy is that, you know, for decades, industry never really monitored the true cost of doing anything because polluting was for free. That's not a good thing, right? And so I think now if you look at your total cost of transport, political costs, all of that stuff, is that the world's becoming, you know, flat, right? China had a huge cost advantage for a long time. That is eroded to where it's practically gone. Yeah. Now, there are other places in the world that may have some cost advantages, but not at the scale. And so I think everything's starting to kind of reshuffle around. And then you tackle in national security. You tackle in the fact that, again, are we in fact in a new era of some kind of standing Cold War? Those all factor into this. And so, yeah, you see a lot of reshoring. You know, some of it's going to be in Mexico because it's, you know, there's still some labor cost advantage. There's risk. But I think again, Austin hasn't lost its juju in my view, right? It's like Silicon Valley. It's reinvented itself. And that's the DNA that you want, because every industry comes to an end, every fad comes to an end. And there are many places in this country that'll ride a fad and then they have no second act.
No, right?
Austin's had second acts, third acts. I mean, it's a place that just reinvents itself consistently. And that's important DNA.
No, there's the foundational principles, I think, of ecosystems. And they're different. Like, we're different than Silicon Valley, than New York, yeah. than Boston. And there's the aspects that are constant in that, right? That's how you can say, like, London in the 1680s, the 1830s, yeah. and the 2024, there's something that maintains, while at the same time, there is that next layer that changes over time via the technological shifts, yeah. the market trends. Like, okay, so 100 years ago, we weren't talking about semiconductors and quantum. We are now, but the fact that we build as a community, that's maintained. And so now we're able to then lean into when we're doing hard tech and manufacturing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it'll happen again. It's just the way it is. And it accelerates, right? I mean, the one thing is common, that change is accelerating. Quantum will cause acceleration to move faster. Again, we'll move from kind of the Moore's law that we all know and love into some kind of weird exponential world on hardware evolution. And that all happened. But again, I think I also say relative to quantum, none of that is possible if you don't have the foundational capabilities in semiconductors, in how to do that. There's a lot of commonality in tackling the quantum hardware issues with the semiconductor issues. And so again, one of the reasons I think Austin's on that list is just the density of people here, the density of investment here, the supply chain that's here. You know, now you have UT standing up a quantum research institute and saying, you know, they have put a stake in the ground. Okay, yeah, we also want to lead in quantum research. And I think you go back to, you know, if I look at this from a country perspective, you know, California became California because it was willing to dream big and back it up. And if you go back 20, 30 years when the state was running massive budget surpluses, they were investing in research. They were investing to maintain their lead. And again, we can have all kinds of discussions of why that stopped. But Texas still has that mentality. Is, you know, this is a place where you can come here and get stuff done and make it happen. And it is a pro-business environment. It is a supportive business environment. This is a place where people who succeed are effectively rewarded and are, you know, and they invest back in the community. You know, there's not a lot of places left in the United States that you have it at this scale anymore. And, you know, I think about quantum again. If there's a battleground in quantum in the United States for manufacturing industrialization, Texas is the place to be, because I think there's just so much momentum here. You have lots of talent moving to the state. You look at places like New York, you have people leaving the state, California, people leaving the state. It's about momentum as well.
So there are a lot of things that we talk about here with the manufacturing and everything that we're saying right, that are kind of cut across, but which make quantum fits in really nicely. Are there any particular differences in infrastructure, talent, capital that are unique to quantum that we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, I think in many ways, quantum is, you know, if you look at analogies, it's kind of in the vacuum tube era. And I don't know if you even know what the vacuum tube era is. I joke, everyone knows the moment they become old. And I was giving, I used to teach some venture courses, and I was giving a lecture one day, and I had just come back from a trip from Seattle, and I walked past an audiophile shop in Seattle, and the guy was selling old vacuum tubes. And there was a boutique dress store next door. And my daughters wanted to go buy dresses, and I went and bought some vacuum tubes. So I had this like collection of really cool vacuum tubes that I came home with that I was really excited about. So I held this vacuum tube up in front of this class of MBAs, and not a single person in that class knew what the hell it was. And two things. It was like, well, I'm really old at this point. This is kind of a generational rift that they don't know what a vacuum tube is. And so I had to go home and think about that one a little bit. But it also taught me that people just...
My young children, there's like, oh, it was black and white television when you were a kid. I was like,
yeah.
No, your grandparents, yes, but I had color.
Yeah, I know. My youngest daughter, I remember a house we had, the phone on the wall with the long cord, and she's like, what? I'm like, she's like, that's the dumbest idea ever. Why would you do that?
Because we couldn't do the things we do today.
Well, I actually had a teacher that her iPhone was a phone. It wasn't a device that you texted. It's like, you have to pick up and talk to people occasionally. So, I think that, so there are unique problems. One of them is we're having to go back and relearn technology that we've kind of forgotten about as a country for a long time. That's unique. We have to resurrect some old technologies. How do you build vacuum systems, very small vacuum systems? I think one of the things that's unique, and this is one of the things that's vexed the semiconductor industry, is how do you build very small lasers with very narrow line widths? And this is, in the traditional semiconductor world, we live in the world of multi-core processors now, right? We can't kind of hit the limit on clock speed, so I got to put a lot of processors on a single chip. We got to connect them. And, the weak link is the connection, getting data back and forth. And so there's the semiconductor industry spent billions of dollars trying to solve these interconnect issues. So the quantum industry has some of the same challenges because we're moving things around with lasers. And so how do you do this at very low cost, very small form factor, and using traditional machine infrastructure? So in the semiconductor world, could you do this in silicon? In the quantum world, it's going to be silicon nitride, which is kind of a first cousin, dope mm-hmm. silicon. But I think, there's some unique things there that, again, based upon what's going on at UT Austin with some of the investments they're making in their packaging infrastructure, that's a third area that there's massive challenges in heterogeneous packaging, where you're putting all kinds of systems together in a small package. Quantum has the same issue. And again, I think one of the things that makes Austin very unique, particularly what UT Austin's doing, is they're putting a stake in the ground and saying, we're going to be best in class in the United States in heterogeneous packaging. They need it for the semiconductor industry, and the quantum industry is going to need that as well.
One of the things, it kind of harkens back to what we were saying with all of the different stuff that's here, which on one hand is why quantum is interesting here, but we just have such a diverse sector mix. Do you think, how do you see quantum, I don't want to say fitting in, but like actually starting to interact? I mean, I think it's great that we have, it's these convergence technologies, I think, is really what is kind of one of the superpowers of Austin. And so if we start building out this more robust quantum infrastructure and ecosystem, how do you see it interacting with everybody?
I think, again, there's clearly an industrial base that gets built here for manufacturing. I think there's another place on the interaction where use cases is, particularly when you start unlocking quantum computing, the things that you can invent, the things that you can do. You know, it's quantum computing is one of these things. It's like, you know, the financial industry will tell you, the logistics, and, you know, there's a 6 or 7 things that people will talk about. You can design new materials. But like any disruptive technology, the real transformational impact of it doesn't come from the things that we think it's going to be good for. We can justify the investment because we know it's going to create this economic value, so I can get a return on it. The real transformational value is that you have this very powerful tool that, if you democratize it, and this is one of the things I think needs to be important, that quantum shouldn't be something that runs in a data center behind a pristine wall. There are companies that are building those kinds of quantum solutions. There are companies like Infleqtion that are trying to democratize it. We want it to be on the edge. We want it to be everywhere for everyone else. So when you unlock those tools, the things that you can create are the real inflection points. Those are the real value adds. And I think that's where you're going to get a lot of interaction. And it's going to be one of the things that we were doing at Infleqtion, for example, is that we had a quantum matter machine. It truly wasn't a computer. It was literally a state of matter we could create. And we let it loose. We let it loose on the web for people to play with it. And people were creating artwork on it. People were, trying to solve DNA protein from. People were trying to do all kinds of creative things with it. And I think if you look at Austin as just an enormously creative place, that's where the intersection will be. And one of the things that I think would be kind of interesting is, how do you combine, you know, the creative aspect of South By with some of the capabilities of what quantum can do? And I think those are things that, you know, quantum had a big role at South By this year. I think it's going to be bigger next year, because there is this convergence of creatives being able to access these tools and do cool things with it. I mean, it's not just how do you make life more productive, but how do you make for a better life?
It's funny how this keeps coming up, and these you know, things rhyme, because I just did an episode with Blake Sabatinelli, the CEO of Atmosphere, and his answer to the question that's coming up for you in a second of what's next Austin was, we're going to be the hub and the place to be for the creative use of AI. And yeah, you start thinking about this intersection of innovation, technology, and creativity, and then just insert whichever technology you want, whether it be, you know, AI, quantum, bio, etc. It becomes a really interesting mix of things. So yeah, I think it's a great place to then tee it up for you. So I always like to end with the same question: what's next, Austin?
Yeah, look, I think it is. I think next Austin, you know, everyone says this, everyone wants to be this. It is the epicenter of the technology industry in the United States, in my view. It is what Silicon Valley once was and priced its way out of, and politicized its way out of it. You need that as an economic engine for this country to be successful. And I say this country, if Silicon Valley didn't exist, and there are areas that do some cool stuff, so I'm not, you know, and I've worked in some of those areas, but Silicon Valley existed at such a scale, and that's really what was the foundation. And I think that, you know, Austin has all the right ingredients to exist at that scale. It's scale of creative, it's scale of industrial, it's scale of capital. You need all of those things to come together. And again, there are other places in the country that I think are good. You know, Boston is a great area because you have a density of academic institutions, but Austin has the mix of world-class research centers, world-class industries. It's all here in it, but it also has this attitude of, we can do it and we are going to do it. And that's what's missing in other parts of the country. And I think people are attracted to that. And I think that, you know, maybe isn't, you know, keep Austin weird, you know, the old axiom, but, you know, how do you get to weird at scale? That, I think, weird is the interesting opportunity.
Scott, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Enjoyed it.
So what's next, Austin? We're glad you've joined us on this journey. Please subscribe at your favorite podcast catcher, leave us a review, and let your colleagues know about us. This will help us grow the podcast and continue bringing you unique interviews and insights. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.